This is Brian Cambria with news for the KVNF listening area Monday, April 1st, 2013. The state lawmakers are in the midst of debating the annual budget, and even though there's more money than last year, Republicans are not happy with the bill. As part of our Capital Conversation series, Benta Berkland discusses the politics behind the budget and what's driving the discussion.
I'm here with Joe Hannell with the Durango Herald and Charles Ashby with the Grand Junction Daily Sentinel. Charles, last year Colorado had split legislative control with Democrats in charge of the Senate and Republicans holding the House majority. We saw an historic vote in favor of the budget. Lawmakers on all sides praised it. A much different tone from Republicans this time around now that Democrats control the legislature.
Well, that's the politics of the state budget. When you're in the majority, you're supposed to be the adult in the room and you're supposed to vote for the policies and the budget that is their, quote, moral document. Last year, the Republicans had control of the House, and so they had an input in the budget, and they were proud of what they were able to do to it. This year, they don't. They're in the minority in both the House and the Senate. And they're still upset over some of the other bills that have come through, such as the gun bills. And so they're still making it out of the politics. And that's really what it comes down to. I've said this many times before to you, Benta. You can never separate the politics from this building, no matter what it is you're talking about. If you're talking about getting breakfast, what's the politics of it? It's always there.
And Joe, this year it's a little bit different because for the first time the state has more wiggle room. They're starting to restore cuts. And when you look at the surface and the talking points from both parties, it seems like there would be broad areas of agreement. They talk about economic development, jobs, education, even mental health.
Yeah, and those are all items that are in the budget. More importantly, the last few years, Governor Hickenlooper came in and really cut the school budget pretty drastically. He came in after Governor Ritter, who was trying to minimize budget cuts at all costs. Hickenlooper said, we need to match our budget to our means. Now that the economy is improving, they've got a really solid foundation to build off of, and they have a lot of extra money that's just kind of laying around in savings. And this is what Republicans have been going after for years, trying to say, we need to save more money, we need to save more money. This year, they are expanding the size of their reserve account and keeping hundreds of millions of dollars left over in the school fund for a possible downturn in the future. Despite that, we're still kind of back at the same budget arguments that we heard in 2008.
Do you agree with Charles? You're not surprised, just given the political dynamic?
This is my eighth session, and this is probably as heated as I've seen the politics get. The gun bills, definitely. I think they've pretty much poisoned the atmosphere here for the rest of the year. Senator Kent Lambert, an influential Republican on the Budget Committee, he said he's not voting for the budget, and he cited the reason as not the budget itself, but the other bills that have passed through the legislature. It's like they're just distancing themselves from not just from the budget, but from the entire legislature and anything the legislature does.
It has been a very busy session, more so in my 17 years here.
Well, la-ti-da.
Well, yeah. But we've seen, you know, in those years we've seen some big issues come and go, but not so many big issues, and we've had a lot of them. And yeah, Joe is absolutely right. It is the gun bills that have set them off. And, you know, it's funny how they are putting all that together in the budget bill, which has nothing to do with the gun bills, has nothing to do with some of these other issues that they're upset about, but they're taking it out, you know, in the budget bill. So I'm not quite sure why that is. Maybe it is just what Joe says, that they're not going to be able to come together on anything. But it's always a good political tool for both sides to use. So maybe that's the reason why.
We'll see if they come together on any oil and gas regulations and also regulating recreational marijuana, which they still have to do. That was Charles Ashby with the Grand Junction Daily Sentinel, Joe Hannell with the Durango Herald, and Benta Berkland, and this was Capital Conversation.
The Grand Junction Daily Sentinel reports that current safety regulations for oil and gas pipelines and the adequacy of enforcement are likely to undergo new scrutiny in light of the discovery in early March of a leak near Parachute. Some 6,000 gallons of a liquid hydrocarbon were recovered near Parachute Creek in a pipeline corridor 4 miles northwest of town. Some 176,000 gallons of groundwater were also contaminated, and the carcinogen benzene has been found in nearby wells. The Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission focuses more on regulating drilling and well pad activities than on regulating pipelines. Local, state, and federal governments have some hand in pipeline regulations, and gray areas inevitably arise. Nationwide, pipeline safety is regulated by the Department of Transportation's Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, with rules about construction, testing, inspection, and maintenance. However, its regulations apply to only about 10% of the 200,000 miles of natural gas gathering lines nationwide, and a similar 10% of the 40,000 hazardous liquids gathering lines, this according to a 2012 Government Accountability Office report. In addition, rural areas are shortchanged. The Safety Administration doesn't regulate natural gas gathering lines in areas with fewer than 10 buildings per mile intended for human occupancy within 220 yards of a line. Deborah Goldberg, an attorney with Earth Justice, questions what she calls, quote, a kind of a cost-benefit analysis by the government dismissing the risk in natural areas, saying, quote, frankly, the people who live in the low-populated areas, their lives are as important to them as populated areas, end quote. Energy companies rely on monitoring pressure flow as one means of detecting leaks. When the parachute leak was first detected, companies cited a lack of pressure drops, indicating that pipeline didn't appear to be leaking. A study conducted for the Pipeline Safety Administration acknowledged that such monitoring will likely catch only large ruptures. The Bureau of Land Management imposes pipeline conditions that vary depending upon the project and are addressed through environmental assessments, said agency spokesman Vanessa Lacayo. She said petroleum engineers and other BLM staff do inspections to ensure requirements are followed. She said the BLM works with the Safety Administration on all pipeline right-of-way projects. Recently, energy companies proposed two Garfield County lines crossing beneath the Colorado River, a drinking water source for downstream communities in Colorado and beyond. According to the environmental analysis and approval decision for one of them, the entire 30-inch diameter line, which also would cross several tributaries to the river, would be subject to Safety Administration testing requirements. The New York Times reports that colony collapse, which has been killing honeybees en masse since 2005, appears to have expanded drastically in the last year, wiping out up to 50% of the commercial hives needed to pollinate many of the nation's fruits and vegetables. Here in the North Fork Valley, healthy bee colonies continue to swarm and thrive. But there are threats, as KVNF's Marty Derlin reports.
Back on March 6th, fourth grader Noah McDaniel reported to IC Change that he'd seen his first bee of the season during recess at Paonia Elementary. A few weeks later, at Karen von Gontard's farm on Lamborn Mesa, the bees are, well, busy.
They're gathering pollen, and they're gathering nectar, and they're gathering propolis. The queen is probably very actively laying, so they're having to tend to the larva, and when they hatch, they have to go clean the cells and take care of everything.
Karen's keeping her bees healthy and happy using biodynamic principles, developed nearly a century ago by Rudolf Steiner, founder of Montessori Education. The idea is to regenerate the earth, to create balance using the natural elements of the farm itself, working with seasonal and planetary changes. Even the shape of the hives invites the bees to do their natural thing.
We're trying to allow the bees as much as possible to duplicate what they would do in nature. In a natural hive, if you've ever seen a wild hive, a feral hive that's out, say, in a big tree, they love to go in the big cottonwood trees. And if you look in there, you'll see that they build almost in a big heart shape. And when you open these hives, that's what they're duplicating, is they're making kind of a heart shape on that frame because they're free to build it the size and the shape they want.
But commercial bees have been forced to build their cells in a uniform way. They've been hybridized, fed a mono diet supplemented with corn syrup, subjected to herbicides and pesticides in genetically modified plants. They're moved hundreds of miles by truck. The true queens have been supplanted by engineered queens. Their diverse habitat has disappeared.
You know, they say that 3 out of every 5 bites of food we take depends upon a pollinator. And it's not just the kept bees that are disappearing. The wild feral bees have been decimated by habitat destruction and the chemicals and all these things. So, you know, we're in trouble.
Add climate change to the mix, and the bees are challenged.
The seasonal changes are very confusing. One of the risks, I think, is because we have these real warming trends in the middle of the winter. They wake up. They're not kept quite so still in hibernation. They wake up. They start flying around. They have more need to eat, and they can go through their honey stores. Because they go out, and there's still nothing blooming. There's nothing out there for them to eat. So they're expending the energy to go out when it gets warm like that. And the opposite is true as well. When we get these brutally cold spells, they have to keep the hive warm. The hive is kept at our body temperature inside. And the way they do that is they disengage their wings and flex their muscles that are underneath. So they flex all those muscles in their under their wings, their wing muscles, and vibrate them. And that generates heat in the hive. Well, that can be exhausting if it's a long, prolonged spell. They can get to the point where they aren't able to get around in the hive to get to their honey stores. Their honey stores may be one comb back, and it's too cold for them to move there. So, you know, all of these climatic changes are obviously affecting the bees. And this is happening so fast. It's not to say that the earth or the animals or even us, that we couldn't adapt to these changes we're bringing on. Maybe we could, but not this fast. You know, it's not normal for things to have to change so quickly, and they don't have time to make the adaptations in their genetic code.
Bees sacrifice for each other and the hive. They work cooperatively. They don't waste time. They create our food through their work as pollinators. They make honey, which is not only delicious, but antibacterial, antifungal, and antiseptic. It builds organs and bones and fights allergies. We use their wax for candles and other items.
They're remarkable. They're the most fascinating creature, and we would learn a lot by paying attention to the way they live and trying to emulate them.
For ICChange at thealmanac.org and KVNF News, I'm Marty Derlin, buzzing around.
There were 750 cranes last night at the Fruit Growers Reservoir in Delta County. That brings the total observed there so far this season to over 11,000. Yesterday I was walking along the North Fork River and heard a cacophony of frogs croaking away. And I had to wonder, is it that time already? What have you seen change this spring? Is it the same as any other spring? Is it different? You can be part of the discussion at IC Change. You can be part of the community of life on the Western Slope. Visit thealmanac.org to be part of Two-Way Radio. Thus concludes today's newscast. I leave you with this. Today's April 1st, April Fool's Day, of course, about which Mark Twain said, "The 1st of April is the day we remember what we are the other 364 days of the year." For KVNF News, I'm Brian Cambria.